The past 8 years have seen lots of changes in the operation of the state of Wisconsin, from education to health care, from transportation to business development. And much of that change, whether you felt it was good or bad, happened because Republicans controlled both the legislature and the governor's chair. Well, that changes Monday. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Collin, back in for Kate Archer Kent. Democrat Tony Evers is sworn in on Monday to replace Scott Walker. And we're going to take some time to look ahead at what we might expect from a divided government in Wisconsin in the coming year. We welcome J.R. Ross, the editor of WisPolitics.com, and we'll join him in a moment. But in the meantime, when it comes to state politics, what will you be watching for in the coming year? Call 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. J.R. Ross, the editor of WisPolitics, is with us. Good morning, J.R.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. The gubernatorial election, well, it was one of the closest elections in recent memory, and Governor-elect Tony Evers bested Scott Walker by just over a percentage point. So judging by the result, I think it's fair to say that Wisconsin remains a divided state. What challenges does that create for both Evers and the state legislature, which continues to be led by the GOP?
Well, what can they agree on? The best example we have in recent memory is 2003-2005, which is when then-Democrat Governor Jim Doyle took office and had Republicans controlling both houses of the legislature. Back then, I think he vetoed like 101 bills, give or take, in that first two-year period. And the pace of bills getting done slowed quite a bit compared to what happens when you have unified government. So what's that going to look like? Is that the kind of the gauge to look at for this? And then you have to look at the early comments from both sides since the election. Republicans have tried very hard to minimize the Evers win. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, for example, often says that if you take away the margin of victory in Dane County for Evers, he would not have a majority of the vote statewide. I'm not quite sure why he's so focused on Dane County, but he's trying to minimize the idea that Evers has some kind of a mandate by winning statewide election. So it seems like Evers is not getting much of a honeymoon, if any kind of a honeymoon in that regard. And then, two, you have Evers. He made a lot of promises in the campaign, things like, you know, he wants to look at ways to get more money into roads. He wants to roll back the manufacturing ag tax credit, we call it, which benefits manufacturers and farmers to cap the how much money you can make so qualify for. There are things like that. The Republicans are saying, no, we're not going to do that. Mm-hmm. The question is, what can they do? Where can they agree? I'm not quite sure we figured that out yet.
Yesterday, Evers suggested that it would take a lawsuit for him to go along with certain parts of the lame duck legislation that curbed his powers, and the Republicans would have to do the litigating. He said he anticipated most of the provisions would be challenged and that he guessed he would be a defendant rather than a plaintiff. How does that color the start of his tenure?
Well, it doesn't paint a picture of two sides that are going to work together in a lot of things. So obviously Evers complained that this was a power grab with what Republicans pushed through with Governor Walker in the lame duck session. Now, what he hasn't done is say which laws he might ignore and what the justification might be. Is he saying these laws are unconstitutional? We haven't heard that justification yet, so I'm kind of curious to see which ones he's talking about, because the immediate pushback for Republicans was, you can't do that. You can't just pick and choose which laws to enforce. So how's this going to work, and what's the justification? I'm kind of waiting to watch the details play out, because as I've watched Governor like Evers and talk to people about the early going, he hasn't really laid out a lot of specifics. For example, you know, I interviewed him yesterday like other reporters did, and I asked him about, you know, reducing the prison population, one of his promises in the campaign. And he said he'd put the building blocks into his budget to start working for that goal, but wouldn't put specifics in the budget, but he wouldn't tell what those building blocks are. He's not getting a lot of details just yet. So that's what we're kind of looking for, is the specifics of how is Evers going to govern and how Republicans can react to that. How's that going to play out?
Let's bring Nate from Milwaukee into the conversation. Nate, welcome to the morning show.
Hi, and good morning. I am looking forward to, I think, two sets of lawsuits that I actually had not expected back in November. One you were just touching on And I think Governor-elect Evers actually loosely did refer to that he thought the lame duck bills, at least some of them, were unconstitutional because when asked, he compared it to when the Republicans tried to change his powers as state superintendent. Now, the other lawsuit I'm looking forward to is involving the $850,000 Robin Voss wants to spend of taxpayer money to, in addition to the $2 million that they've already gone through, to defending the gerrymandered maps that prevent taxpayers from having honest elections for who runs the state legislature.
J.R. Ross, it's interesting, this quickly into the discussion, when we've been kind of focusing on the changes in the executive branch and the legislative branch, that we're actually spending a lot of time talking about the judicial side of this. Are lawsuits going to be as much a part of this administration as legislation?
That's a good question. I've been covering the Capitol now for almost 19 years. When I first came up here, I never thought I'd spend so much time in court covering politics. But that has been a mainstay over the course of that time. So, yeah, I mean, we're going to see how some of that stuff plays out. What the caller brought up with redistricting, what's fascinating there is, you know, Tony Evers winning, I mean, you cannot downplay the significance of that for Democrats overall with those maps, because if Scott Walker won re-election, you would likely have had Republicans drawing those maps again in 2021 as long as they held on the state Senate, because the Assembly, the majority is so large, people think Democrats could flip that. But with Evers now, you're not going to have unified government. They can't draw the maps. Therefore, we're going back to court, most likely, and the courts will draw the maps. That is much better for Democrats than what happened, you know, 9 years ago, 8 years ago, mm-hmm. and put in better shape for those legislative races going forward starting in 2022. It's a huge thing for them.
Now, one of the first thing lawmakers will have to tackle is a state budget, and there's already debate over who's going to be in control of that process. You talked about Evers beginning to draft a budget. Talk about what we've heard so far when it comes to the budget.
Well, Republican legislative leaders have talked about working off what we call the base. Now, in the base, it's a two-year budget, and so when building the next budget, they take the second year, what you're allocated, that's your base, okay? What Republicans are talking about is that ignoring what Evers proposes, likely in February or early March, and working off the base for these agencies, so that way they're basically, the policies of Governor Walker would still be the foundation of that budget. Now, and asking people about that prospect, that's a lot of heavy lifting, all right, and building a budget. You're talking about line by line of these agencies' requests and figuring out what you want to use as the base or where you want your starting point to be. So in talking to folks, I get the impression that maybe Republicans will start with the base on big picture things like taxes, like schools, but maybe work off of Evers' request for like smaller agencies, because the big fights are not going to be over these smaller agencies. They're going to be about whether they're going to allow a gas tax increase or a rollback of manufacturing agriculture tax credit, whether they're going to allow Evers to do the full funding of the Department of Public Instruction request that he put forth as state superintendent, things like that. So it could be a mix. Whatever they do, though, the Joint Finance Committee is going to be controlled by Republicans 12-4. Yeah. That's our budget.
J.R. Ross, so, editor of WisPolitics.com, and we'll continue our conversation about the year ahead of Wisconsin politics. Do you think divided government will be a good or bad thing for our state? 800-642-1234. Dean Collin back in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Dean Collin, back in for Kate Archer Kent. After news, at the bottom of the hour, we'll talk about our clothing and the impact it has on the environment. For now, we continue to focus on the upcoming year in state politics. What do you see as the most pressing issue in the state that you're hoping to see tackled? What are you hoping to see from new Governor Tony Evers? And do you think divided government will be good or bad for the state? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Our guest is J.R. Ross. He's the editor of WisPolitics.com. And we bring into the conversation Jimmy from Valley Junction. Jimmy, thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network.
Morning. Yeah, I would think that at some point there'd be at least a symbolic effort to restore union negotiating rights to state, local, and teacher unions that was taken away under Scott Walker early on in his administration. It'll be a tough row to hoe because the legislature's still in Republican hands, but I think he has to at least appear to be moving in that direction.
J.R. Ross, is this going to be a priority to get the unions built back up, and is that even possible after the Janus decision?
It's a fascinating issue because I've asked people about this for several years now, especially in election time. And for Democrats, the issue is their base really wants to see the restoration of collective bargaining powers. I mean, that is a core issue that a lot of public employee unions and other organized labor support Democrats. This is a key issue for them about working people and those kinds of things. The issue is for Democrats that if you look at the general public, it's not a fight they kind of want to keep having. You know, we had a very contentious period in 2011 when Governor Walker pushed this through the Republican-controlled legislature. We had the recalls in 2012. And I get the impression, talking to folks on both sides of the aisle, they don't think voters really want to have that big fight again. They just, it's settled, just kind of be done with it. So if you're a Democrat, how do you approach that issue where you let the base know that you're engaged, you're paying attention to it, without kind of like, I don't know what the right word is, but maybe like bringing back up the bad memories of that fight for the people in the middle who you need to win election time? So I will be watching to see if Evers has some kind of symbolic push toward restoration of those powers. I mean, if he puts it in his budget, for example, it's obvious Republicans will not go along with that. They're not going to go back on that issue to where we were before. But what might he do instead, or is there a proposal out there that tries to, again, a nod to that base of saying, hey, you know, I'm paying attention to what's important to you?
Shifting gears a bit, one of the more contentious issues in recent years has been how to pay for roads in Wisconsin. Even the Republicans had trouble agreeing on that in previous budgets. To that end, Governor-elect Evers is tapping Executive Director of the Wisconsin Transportation Development Association, Craig Thompson, as his DOT secretary. Thompson has previously supported an increase in a gas tax or a fee increase. Does that signal what we would see for transportation policy going forward?
Possibly, you know, Governor Evers has talked about trying to find more money for roads, about being open to various proposals. The question, kind of like with everything, is what could they agree on? Remember the fight with Republicans and Walker in the last budget. Assembly Republicans, generally speaking, not all of them, pushed an idea of cutting other taxes to allow for a gas tax increase. That idea, however, did not go very far in budget negotiations. So is there really truly an appetite, and it never was put to a vote by the two houses, so is there really an appetite in both Republican caucuses to raise taxes of any kind, especially with a Democratic administration? That I don't know about. The other thing is, you know, this whole budget process, if Republicans ignore what Evers wants and they do their own budget, you know, where are they going to put that in and how are they going to agree to it? And if you're going to try to find agreement between Evers and Republicans, might you have to break the transportation piece totally off of the rest of the budget? That happened, last time it happened was in the mid to late 90s before I got up here, but they've done it before, the transportation budget by itself. So people wondered, maybe that's a way to try to figure out a compromise, but I don't know how it's going to play out just yet.
Let's extend our conversation out to Sun Prairie and bring Steve into the mix. Steve, welcome to the morning show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. One of the things I do like what the Republicans are doing is kind of taking a page out of the Democrats with Trump and this whole resist movement against Evers and what he wants to do. Historically, the Republicans have been very weak-kneed when it comes to resisting. You know, they get the media onslaught and they start caving to the pressure. Just wondering if you think the guests will actually think that the Republicans will have the gumption and the strong will to continue to resist Evers every chance they get and represent their voters, not the people that dislike them.
J.R., it seems to me that the people in the leadership, in the Republican leadership in the legislature, have not been shy violets about this sort of thing.
Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has been trying to position himself as the leading conservative voice against Governor-elect Evers in talking to people on both sides of the aisle about what they're seeing kind of post-November 6th. They see Voss positioning himself to try and lead the charge against Evers and be kind of like, I would say, the anti-governor, I don't know if the right word to use, but be the foil to Evers. And if you look at the two caucuses, the Assembly Republicans have such a large majority, they're not in any danger of losing that chamber in the next round of elections, just because the maps are so good for them. Those kind of, the majority is so large, it's very difficult to see them losing the majority. The Senate, the map is not great for Democrats in 2020 in terms of seats that are up. If you look at the results of the 2018 race and kind of project them out. But it's a much more difficult caucus to manage because it's a little bit more diverse in kind of the political spectrum. So for Voss, we fully expect in talking to people to see Robin Voss continue to be that person standing up to Evers almost any time he can and worried more about keeping that base engaged and happy than about losing voters in the middle because his members depend on voters on the right to keep them coming back every time with the maps that they have.
Our guest is J.R. Ross. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. Join us at 800-642-1234. J.R. Ross, Tony Evers has announced several names to fill spots in his administration's cabinet. More coming this afternoon, I understand. All the appointments are subject to Senate confirmation. Are any of these individuals in for a fight in the Senate?
Craig Thompson, Transportation. We've already heard complaints from Republicans that, you know, he advocated for revenue increases as a lobbyist, that he lobbied on these issues, so therefore there's going to be an issue there. The question I have about things like that are, okay, how's this going to work? Because if you go to the Senate right now, you're going to have a 19-14 Republican majority in the Senate. If they allow a floor vote by the full chamber, we're going to see 14 Democrats back that nominee. Will there be three Republicans who would, if there is a problem, I'm not projecting for sure there will be, but if there is an issue with Craig, will there be three Republicans who break ranks with the others and vote for him? If they do, he still gets confirmed. That's a big question I have. How are they going to negotiate that? Because oftentimes in caucuses, you only take something to the floor if you have a majority of the caucus or if you have enough votes from the caucus by itself to pass something. So if you have 17 Republican votes, well, I'm not sure that's going to happen just yet. So how is that going to play out? Something to watch that for people like me, it's going to be fascinating.
I don't recall Wisconsin ever having a floor fight over a cabinet position before. Do you remember that? I just don't.
I remember plenty of party line votes on appointments. I'm trying to think of the last round of secretaries, an incoming governor. It's been 8 years.
Yeah.
So it remember a little foggy about that. But
that's all right.
First, I remember there's already been a dust up right at the appointment. Usually it's pretty, people play nicely. And there's also a philosophy of, you allow a governor to have his or her cabinet because that's the person that's his or her cabinet, right? His picks going forward. So we'll see how that plays out too.
We've talked about the governor's position. Let's talk a little bit about another important job. We'll see someone new coming in, Attorney General Democrat Josh Call replacing Republican Brad Schimmel. What should we know about the incoming Attorney General?
He was a federal prosecutor for several years out in Baltimore. Was in private practice. He part of the lawsuit over voter ID that was successful in Wisconsin. His mother, Peg Lautenschlager, was attorney general from 2003 to 2007. So that's an interesting connection. Other thing you should know is, how is he going to navigate these new laws that Republicans pushed through last month? I fully expect lawsuits over those from somebody. I'm not sure who just yet. But he kind of comes in a little bit more of an unknown than Evers because he hasn't had a much of a record in public office in Wisconsin. This is going to be an interesting watch. How does he navigate being attorney general, and what kind of AG will he be? Our examples of Democrats in recent memory are Peg Lautenschlager and Jim Doyle. You know, Doyle was kind of a law and order type Democrat. Peg, I remember her focusing a lot on consumer protection and those kinds of things, the environment. Where is his emphasis going to be? And every attorney general I've ever covered walks in the office thinking, I could be governor someday. It's just kind of the way the job works. So is this a springboard for Call to something else down the road?
Supreme Court races have been testy in recent years. This one, I would think, is going to be significant because the incumbent's not running. Shirley Abrahamson is retiring after a long term on the Wisconsin Supreme Court. In 15 seconds, what do we know about how this race is shaping up so far?
This race sets the stage for 2020. Progressives have to hold this seat of Abrahamson to maintain a 4-3 conservative majority. If they do that, they have a shot next spring with Daniel Kelly, who was appointed by Governor Walker, to retake control of the state Supreme Court. Yeah, Lisa Neubauer and Brian Hagedorn, both appeals court judges. Neubauer is considered the left of center candidate. Hagedorn is a Walker appointee, is the conservative candidate. This is the race that sets the stage. If liberals can win this race, 2020 is going to be an all-out war for control of the state Supreme Court.
J.R. Ross, thanks for joining us. He's editor of WisPolitics.com. Up next is news. Then we talk about the way we buy, use, and dispose of fashion impacts and how fashion impacts the environment. Dean Collin back in for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Kate Archer Kent is off today. I'm Dean Collin back. Happy to be with you this morning. New year, new wardrobe. Just make sure it doesn't culminate in a trash bin full of clothing. An apparel expert joins us to talk about how the clothing we buy, wear, and throw out impacts the environment. We also learn what we can do to put a dent in the problem in this new year. When you're done with clothing, how do you dispose of it? Do you go to great lengths to avoid the trash bin and drive to a Goodwill or another secondhand shop that gives it a second life? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Happy to be joined this morning by Sherry Marnell. Sherry Marnell is Program Director for Apparel Design and Development at UW-Stout in Menominee. Sherry Marnell, welcome to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Dean. I'm excited to be here.
Good to have you. There's a statistic that's been repeated over and over again that global fashion is the second most polluting industry in the world. But some journalists have started to dispel that. Sherry, what do we know about just how much of an impact this industry has on the environment?
Yeah, great question, Dean. There definitely is different research on the exact kind of quantity or statistics. But in the end, we all own doing what's right. And we as consumers can do better in the environment, specifically related to fashion. Some statistics that are out there is us as Americans discard 70 pounds of clothing every single year. So each of us discarding 70 pounds of clothing, and 85% of that end up in landfills or incinerators.
Yesterday on The Morning Show, one of our topics was getting organized for the new year, and I shared the story that on New Year's Day, I actually did something I had meant to do for a long time and took all my sweaters and put them in one place and, you know, decided which of these had grown too small or too pilly or just, you know, were out of fashion or whatever. Ended up with 20 of them going to the local nonprofit thrift store. As part of that conversation was about decluttering our closets, and it seems to be an area of focus this time of year. Let's say we decide to toss the clothing we don't want in the trash. What's the journey that a piece of clothing takes from there?
Yeah, great question. Throwing it in the trash literally takes it just to the landfill. So I highly recommend doing exactly what you did and taking it to a donation location. So there's lots of different options. You know, Goodwill is one of the, or Salvation Army are two of the larger options that will recycle that and sell it in a nonprofit manner. And be able to allow people to thrift those items and give those items a second life.
What is the main problem with the clothing going to the landfill? Just capacity in the landfills?
Yeah, exactly. There's some research that's been created, Dean, that the U.S. landfills since the year 2003, we've had an increase of 38% of textiles into our landfills.
Wow.
However, the overall landfills have went down by 1%. So if you can just imagine if we didn't throw them into our landfills, how much of a reduction our U.S. landfills would have. So I highly recommend not throwing them away. But there's a lot of great organizations that are working to upcycle or recycle clothes that maybe you don't know how to fix, or they have holes blown in the knees. I know my kids have lots of pants with big holes in the knees that are kind of unrepairable.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of organizations like Cotton Works that's working to have an area where we can recycle those into new threads and fibers where consumers can then, instead of buying 100% fresh cotton, it's maybe a mix of recycled cotton or even recycled polyester in with new to kind of give it a new different type of second life of your clothing.
Sherry Marnell is our guest. She's the program director for apparel design and development at UW-Stout in Menominee. When you're done with clothing, how do you dispose of it? Do you toss it in the trash, or do you drive to a secondhand shop, someplace where it gets a second life with someone new? And when you or your children's shirts or pants get ripped or damaged, do you take it to a seamstress or repair it yourself? Is it easier just to go out and buy a new garment, and why? We'd like to hear from you. 800-642-1234. Sherry Marnell, sounds like trashing the item, not the best option. So then what should people do with clothes they don't want? And is that sort of donation to a place like a Savers or a Goodwill enough to pat yourself on the back and say, hey, I'm not part of the problem?
That's definitely better than throwing it in the garbage, I would say, as an easy step. Definitely sending it to a thrift store is a great option. But I also would encourage the listeners, especially with the 2019 new year, to take on a new skill. Learn how to sew a button on. Learn how to get a stain out of an item versus throwing it away. Or you can even, it's very simply, buy iron-on patches that you can put on a hole that's just starting, so you can last, those items can last just a little bit longer. I know those are some of the things that I personally have done for my family. You know, and not everyone has access to a sewing machine, but it's very easy to get needle and thread, small sewing, mending kits. And also know brands that do that for you as well. You know, there's a lot of great brands out there, such as Patagonia, North Face, Lululemon, that if their clothing does go into, you know, disrepair, if the zipper breaks or there's a hole, you can send them back and they will mend them for you, if that's maybe not your skill set.
Say, if one of those donation places, if, you know, you've decided that it's not something, if they decide it's unsalvageable and they can't sell it, what do they do with it? It just goes to the landfill then?
Great question. It all depends on the level of severity of the issue.
Yeah.
A lot of them will send them potentially to overseas locations or even homeless shelters. There's also some organizations, depending on the city that you live in, that there are companies locally that can grind up those fibers and create some recycled fibers from it. But it's grown a lot over the years. It's not accessible to all thrift stores, but we're heading in the right direction, which is the optimism in me.
Let's turn to our callers. We've heard from Vern and Boyd. Vern, welcome to the morning show.
Good morning. Great to be on. I was just going to mention something. Back in the early 50s, we all had cotton and wool, and we took it to a person that would collect this, and they would recycle it. They'd bleach it and all that stuff. But now, the biggest clothing article nobody thinks about are the plastic baby diapers. Mm. They're dumped in the landfills by the millions.
Now, that's true.
So that's probably one of the biggest things that needs to be fixed. Go back to the cloth diapers.
Thanks, Vern. Sherry Marnell, is there any momentum in going back to cloth diapers?
Great question. I can't speak from a statistics perspective or valid research, but I can definitely say for my own personal life that there is some momentum to go back to cloth diapers. There's a huge movement, and from a sales perspective, I know that usable or reusable cloth diapers is making somewhat of a comeback. Not quite there. There's still a lot of services that you're able to provide for cloth diapers. But I think what I also heard him say was just kind of going back to what we talk about in the apparel industry of man-made fibers versus natural fibers. So cotton and wool are natural fibers, where plastic or synthetic fibers like nylon are those that are created by man.
Mm-hmm.
So those are the fibers that also don't break down as easy in landfills, such as like cotton and wool would.
Right.
However, there is several organizations now that are working to recycle those man-made fibers. And I can speak specifically to, I know Target Corporation has a corporate social responsibility goal of working to introduce more recycled polyester into their clothing as the years progress, which a lot of people give large companies a lot of kind of rep for the environmental impacts. But there's also a lot of large companies that are able to make big impacts, like the one I just mentioned.
Let's move to Lori. Lori in Stoughton joining us. Hi, welcome to the morning show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I just was so interested in your discussion. I work for Goodwill of South Central Wisconsin. Oh. I just wanted to insert a little more information about what we do with the many, many donations of clothing that we get. A lot of people don't realize we will take things that are stained and or torn. Some of this is sold bundled for salvage, and some of it is actually sold to secondary markets. So Goodwill has really worked to develop recycling streams so that things aren't just sent overseas and dumped, but that there's actually a secondary market and there are good, responsible recycling uses for a lot of these items.
Great. Thank you for calling, Lori. I've got to say, and my team here has insisted that I mention this on the air, the shirt I'm wearing today, I actually bought Monday. It was 80% day at my local second-use thrift store, and I snapped it up for a whole buck. And I think it looks okay.
Wow.
It looks okay on the radio anyway. So, Sherry, I want to zoom out for a second. Have we as a society always had so much clothing to dispose of?
No. Actually, Western consumers are thought to buy 60% more clothing today than they did just 10 years ago. We're buying more, but not spending more of our average household income. I know I've seen statistics that we have continued to spend the same average household income today as we did from the 1950s, but our closet is 80% larger than what it was back then. We had fewer clothes. Fast fashion is what we talk about a lot in the apparel industry. We are demanding new, which is causing, lower prices and more disposable clothing. Oftentimes things that are very affordable come with poor quality. And like I mentioned earlier, our society doesn't know how to mend a hole anymore and put a button on. And unfortunately, 80% of us don't even know that this is happening and that we're sending all of this textiles and garments to the landfill.
Well, hopefully we're helping to mend that part of the process anyway by talking about this issue. Sherry Marnell is the Program Director for Apparel Design and Development at UW-Stout in Menominee. Have you found clever ways to reuse your clothing you no longer wear? Do you turn it into something new? Share that with us. How do you make the clothing you already have last? We want to hear your tips and tricks. And what questions do you have for our guest about fashion's impact on the environment? I'm Dean Kallenbach, in for Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Dean Kallenbach in for Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about our clothing habits and how they affect the environment. When you and your children's shirts or pants get ripped or damaged, do you take it somewhere to get it repaired or fix it yourself? How do you make the clothing you already have last? We want to hear what you have to say. 800-642-1234. Ideas at WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Sherry Marnell is the Program Director for Apparel Design and Development at UW-Stout in Menominee. She is our guest. And let's go to the phones and find Dara. 38% increase in landfills we talked about earlier. Dara from Franklin, join us. You want to talk about that?
Well, actually, I just had a couple of questions.
Yeah.
This topic really struck a chord with me, and I wanted to ask, when I heard that statistic, I wanted to ask your guest if that statistic includes, purses, shoes, other maybe even sporting kinds of things that a lot of kids and a lot of adults buy today. or if that excludes that, if it's just exclusively, you know, clothing. And my second question is a lot of the stuff that's produced today, what we refer to as the textiles, is a lot of that petroleum-based since we've moved away from cottons and linens and other more natural fibers?
Sherry Marnell.
Great question, Mara. So first, to answer your first question in regards to the 30% increase in the amount of textiles, great clarification. So textiles is a very broad term. So it's not just clothing. It's also anything that's made of fabric. So think of your towels, your sheets, curtains, some of your kids' equipment, you know, maybe hockey breezers that are made of fabric. So textiles in general are a very broad category. But anything that's made out of a fabric would be considered textiles. And some of that, too, are items that we don't really even think of as a textile, like potentially some of our shoes are now made of a knit material on the top of a sneaker versus leather. But all of those would be considered textiles. And then to answer your second question, in regards to what fiber content is what we call it in apparel, I don't have the exact statistic, but I would say that the petroleum-based fibers that you're talking about could be nylon or polyester. I would definitely say that there isn't necessarily a rise in petroleum-based textiles. I personally have seen more trends going back to natural fibers of wool, cotton, tencel, and even hemp. One of our students at UW-Stout just completed a research project to identify what truly is the most sustainable fiber to use. You know, is it organic cotton? Is it tencel, which comes from wood pulp? Is it hemp? Or, you know, what are those most sustainable fibers? And hemp actually is the most sustainable fiber because it uses a much less water to grow than what cotton does. So just to answer your question, I would say I don't see a trend in petroleum-based fibers, but I am happy to report that both petroleum-based fibers as well as natural fibers are lots of companies are working to reduce and upcycle those and recycle those into new fibers. We're not 100% there yet, but we're on our way.
Dara, thanks for your call. Let's move to Cascade and take a call from Kelly. Good morning, Kelly.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. This is an awesome show. So 2 points I'd like to make. One is I think the marketing realm could do a lot to just push secondhand consignment. I live in the Pacific Northwest, and there was a huge, social acceptance of that kind of shopping. And then moving back to the Midwest, my kids' friends really poo-pooed the idea of them getting something at Goodwill, whereas in the Northwest, it was cool. So that's one thing. The second thing is in the minimalism movement, there's a huge emphasis on the capsule wardrobe, which is buying quality, buying things that you really love, and keeping it to a minimum. So it saves on time and having to choose your clothes. You know that everything you've grabbed in your wardrobe is something that you love. And so that's something I'm personally striving for so that I can just do away with the whole having to shop on a regular basis and know that everything I have feels good to me and I'll wear it a lot. So. Oh,
thank you, Kelly. Sherry Marnell, are you familiar with that phrase she used, capsule wardrobes?
I sure am. Kelly made a lot of great points. But capsule wardrobes, you know, at the end of the day, apparel makes you feel good, right? So really making sure that you go through your closet and you choose the items that truly make you feel good, that have a lot of versatility and give you lots of different options. You know, your basic T-shirts, your basic denim, maybe a great blazer that you can dress up or down, depending on what your needs are. But capsule wardrobes is definitely something that I would say is we're moving towards that movement to really simplify that wardrobe. Kelly also mentioned that social acceptance of thrifting or upcycling, yeah. And I would agree, and we all own that. I think we all need to be better at being proud of items that we've had for a long time, and not only that you're proud that you've had them for a long time because it has great quality, but hey, especially in the new year, that it still fits you, right? So instead of just saying, yes, this is my new shirt or this is new, let's change our mindset and be happy and proud of things that are old or upcycled, or that you were able to fix that hole in the toe of your sock, or, you know, put that button back on, so that gave you a little bit extra life on that item.
So maybe that money you spend on the gym, you can use to repair your clothes or something. I'm not sure. Sherry Marnell is the Program Director for Apparel Design and Development at UW-Stout in Menominee. We're talking about clothes and their effect on the environment. Let's say you're someone who likes to keep up with the latest fashions without spending a lot of money, and fast fashion brands have allowed you to do that. How can you keep up with the trends without damaging the environment?
Really, it's about educating yourself on the brands that do good and have solid corporate social responsibility plans. You know, instead of just going to any store, you know, really doing some research to say which stores are doing good for the environment. You know, start looking at the label of your clothing, just like a lot of people are starting to do on food labels. You know, see if it's made out of recycled cotton or recycled polyester. And, you know, start just making small, simple steps. I think it easily can be very overwhelming when you hear some of the statistics that I share. But I think just taking baby steps, especially for a fresh new start of the 2019 new year, is, you know, start educating yourself on companies, brands, and in reading the labels that are in your garments.
We got a call from Martha from Onalaska. She couldn't stay on to go on the air, but she called to say if you don't wash your clothing as often, it'll last longer. If a piece of clothing just has a stain, spot clean it instead of putting it through the wash. You don't need to wash jeans or other clothes every time you wear them. Is that a way we can make the clothing we already have work better, last longer?
Yeah, great, addition to our conversation. So when it comes to the impact fashion has on the environment, there's kind of twofold. One, it's pre-consumer. So everything that the factories and agriculture and the farmers growing a lot of these fiber or, you know, fabrics and fiber contents can do. But then it's the other 50% is us as the consumer. And one very easy way is to conserve water and electricity and gas by washing our clothes less. She is right on in regards to, you know, oftentimes, and my kids are just as guilty, you know, you try something on and it goes into the wash, or you wear it for 3 hours and it goes into the wash. I think we all need to do better, and that's a very simple way to help the environment by conserving water, electricity, and gas, and making items last longer. You know, Dean, you mentioned when you're going through your sweaters that your sweaters had some pilling.
Yeah.
Not everyone knows what pilling is, right? It's the little balls that are created when you have friction on your garments. When you wash clothes, pilling often happens. So it definitely lasts longer when you don't wash as often.
Well, we appreciate having you on. I wonder if in 15 seconds you follow the fashion industry. Could fashion get to the point where people don't have to take such great pains to shop for clothing that doesn't harm the environment?
Great question. I sure hope so. From the research that I've seen, the companies that I follow, our advisory board that comes to our campus twice a year to make sure that our program is right on track, we're all headed in the right direction, but it's not something that happens overnight, and we all own it.
Sherry,
so obviously a lot of people.
Sherry, thank you for joining us. Sherry Marnell, Program Director for Apparel Design and Development at UW-Stout in Menominee. Great to have you with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Just ahead, Lake Superior State University has come out with its annual list of words that people love to hate and would banish if they could. We'll talk about it with two guests from LSSU. I'm Dean Kallenbach in for Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.